Well, it's a joy to be with you again. And I have the pleasure of speaking of some very positive things. And I suppose we should start with what appears to be something very negative to some, which is that the world is now in the midst of an avalanche, and the collapse of human civilization has begun in earnest, and a great shift was made in this last week from the pace and the level of let's say pushback and of tyrannical overstepping of the final boundaries that would activate people to resist, as well as the complete unraveling of the global financial system and the failure of a number of banks, including very large and systemically important banks, which clearly are the beginning stages of the fall of the empire, and not the end. And so people didn't really resist much when it came to losing civil freedoms, like being forced into lockdowns and masking and forced injections, nor did they even resist when they discovered how many people were dying and being disabled and lives destroyed by all of this. But now, when it came to losing their money, now people are rioting in the millions. And just last week, the Prime Minister of France went too far declaring the loss of 2 years of pension that the French people were depending on, especially those nearing retirement age who are about to lose a massive amount of money and the ability to retire and to make their long-held plans a reality. He couldn't get the vote of the parliament, and so he used extra emergency powers to eliminate that, and the riots in not just Paris but all of France are unprecedented, way beyond anything that happened with the yellow vests. And from the video clips that I saw, many police actually were joining the protest, and firemen, but the loyalty to the government on the part of those that the government depends on in order to sustain their power is beginning to crack. And if you saw some of those clips, you also saw the very extreme brutality of the cops who were pushing back against the protests and causing a lot of unnecessary physical harm. But the protests have continued, and I think may not end until their aim is reached. But I think their aim now is much more than just about the pensions. I think everything else has now finally awakened them to the untrustworthiness of the government and the illegitimacy of the system. And once people have lost trust massively, in the so-called authorities and in the media, and once they have recognized that they have been betrayed, I don't think there is any coming back into normality for such nations. But it's not just France. It's spread to many countries, including Israel, where the prime minister, again, overstepped the line by eliminating judicial review, eliminating the last check on tyrannical power by the executive branch. And so massive, almost civil war level protests in Israel. And many of the members of the army, from what I read, did not show up for duty and are on strike. So when you begin to have mutiny in the army, then you know that the system is not any longer stable. So the prime minister did have to backstep a little bit, but the tension is not over. And we are seeing this in many countries, of especially the Western world, which is losing its capacity to sustain the life of its members, and or even the interest in sustaining life. And so this crumbling of the social order and the entire system of social welfare, and of course people have lost trust in the medical establishment and basically all of the institutions, and they're pulling their money out of the banks, and they are beginning to take some very extreme measures. And as the contagion of this revolt spreads, we're going to see ever more chaos and extreme countermeasures as those in power do whatever they need to do to try to hold on to it. So we're in the midst of a final phase of not just a collapse, but a tearing apart of the human race, a rupture of a kind that has no precedent in history, but that has been prophesied to happen, and that is now culminating at the same moment that the international tension between the West on one side and Russia, China, Iran, and others of a growing alliance on the other side is reaching kinetic levels of conflict that's spilling out from Ukraine to many other places now. And the likelihood is that that will continue to escalate to the obvious culmination that is being very rapidly approached. And I just saw today that the both Russia and the U.S. are now refusing to give any data to the other party about nuclear weapon tests or any other information about the military, which puts the situation in a very precarious way, because if someone launches some missiles, that might be a test, but the other side wasn't notified, they could take that easily as a launch and counter-launch a nuclear war that might not even have been intended at the moment. So we're on a hair-trigger situation of balance between life and global destruction. So it's a time that should bring sobriety and an awakening to the nature of the situation within the phenomenal plane that will hopefully give rise to more and more of a concern with and a struggle, if necessary, to attain a level of consciousness in which there can be not only wisdom and understanding of the whys and wherefores and the destiny of all of this, but to enable the consciousness to rise out of its limited vehicle and enter into that non-local field awareness of not just the soul, but of the absolute self, and to attain liberation from all of the internal conflicts that are now reflected so graphically in the macrocosmic conflicts, and to bring about healing at the individual level so that that healing can also have an effect on the morphogenic field and bring healing to the hearts of all of those who are possibly in states of massive anxiety and desperation over the events that are unfolding. And so that's part of the job of satyogis, is to be in such a state of peace and of joy, of recognizing the blessing hidden in what seems to be so catastrophic at an ego level of mortal mind, but which in fact is no trouble or cataclysm at all from the perspective of the infinite self, which is going through a transition from one age to another, and one age of human consciousness, which had reached a very low and decrepit state, must die so that a higher, more beautiful, divine state can be born. And once one understands that, and one understands and feels and the immortality of consciousness, then the fear of death and the fear of loss and the fear of the seeming destruction of our world will be recognized as actually a portal to the birth of a new world that will be ever more beautiful and free of the kinds of conflicts that have led to this culmination. And so in this last period where the margin of time is very slim, we need an extremely direct path to liberation. We don't have the luxury of a long gradual time to sit in ashrams or take pilgrimage walks try to do things in a very slow and stately way of reading lots of books and consulting teachers and taking courses and doing all of that. There's no time for that. The destruction is happening rapidly and will be instantaneous almost when the final curtain goes down and the ruins of a radioactive planet of death have begun to settle. This must happen now, and it must happen quickly for those who wish to graduate from this level of reality and not have to go through it all again. And so this is the moment to understand the spiritual knowledge that is the heritage of the deepest and most profound sages of our history and take their messages deeply into our heart and metabolize them into the realization of the liberated self. And this can happen very, very quickly for those who are wholehearted in their yearning for liberation. And to have the luxury of having compassion and the ability to emanate the energy of divine love and light into a world that is so dark and so filled with fear. So this is our time to serve as beings of light and as bodhisattvas and as those angelic consciousnesses that are non-local and who can, no matter where their bodily vehicles are in space, can send the consciousness anywhere it is needed to supply healing and peace to those who are suffering. This is the time when those who are called and who choose to answer the call will find that the fulfillment of that spiritual potentiality is able to happen very easily because we are simply returning to our true nature at the moment when it is destined that this must happen. So that's the setting of this satsang and the reason for our redoubling our efforts and deepening our understanding of reality at a level that the ego cannot comprehend. And if we do not jettison the ego and reach soul consciousness, then we will not be able to be in that state of love and wisdom that is necessary, because the ego will be angry about things that are happening to it. It will be sad. It will be frightened. It will be in an emotional turmoil that will not permit the downloading of the wisdom and the shakti that will bring about transmutation of the body and of the pranic field and of the the consciousness to ascend into the archetypal realm and beyond into cosmic consciousness and the realization of the absolute self. So this must be our highest priority, and not allow any delusional thoughts of the ego and its desires and its deviations of seeking to hold on to some limited prop or some limited security symbol, because there aren't any. And right now, the worship of mammon itself is being destroyed. Money itself is becoming obsolete, history, useless, worthless, literally. And so the whole basis of modern society is being wiped away in one swipe, and we are being forced to learn again how to exist with each other without the buffer of money to create the illusion of some kind of stratified social order. All of that is now being eliminated. And so it will require that divine power that has the authority and the the goodness of a holistic perspective that's not egocentric, that can reestablish a new order on the basis of divine goodness and not on the basis of any kind of individual profit or of any seeking of of power through might or through demagoguery of some kind, but it all must flow from wisdom and love and from the power of presence that is unshakable in these times when all of those who are not connected to the source of our being will begin to tremble and lose their ability to center and concentrate and to function coherently. So this time is a culling of the herd and a choosing of the light or the dark. And because these polarities are now in their most extreme form, the extreme light in all of its power is available to those who choose it. But to choose it, one must disidentify from matter, from the body, from the narratives of the ego, and from all of the tendencies of the small mind that wants to hold on to something that no longer exists. And we must leave that fantasy of egoic existence and find again our nature that is real and is beyond the polarities of life and death. That unborn self is the only refuge now that will be able to pierce through the eye of the needle and transition from Kali Yuga to the new Sat Yuga that is on its way. So that's the message of this evening that I wanted to give. It's not different than before, but now we are in it, and I think that there are very few people who can remain in denial any longer of the fact that we are in something that is does not have an exit, and that seems to be converging on ultimate destruction. And if we do not see beyond the event horizon of that destruction and the rebirth that must follow, then we will begin to lose hope and faith and even the ability to connect to the source of salvation. So that's basically what I wanted to say, and I'll open the floor. But I know that Nirgun wants me to speak about the next retreat, so I'm going to do that. Tell us what the title is, because we changed it recently.
Yes, it is Spiritual Heroism is Your True Nature, and the subtitle is The Archetype of Hanuman is Being Activated in Your Heart.
Right. So this retreat was originally chosen in part because it's occurring right at the moment of the Hindu holiday of Hanuman Jayanti, which is the celebration of the birth of the great divine hero Hanuman. And I wanted to take advantage of it because that archetype is extremely relevant to our own process. It's also true that later in the month, the whole Charitra of Rama is celebrated. And so this is the month when in India they all of the school children put on plays, and it happens even the professional plays and ballets and dance dramas that present the Ramayana are all put on, and it is it's very joyous to again relive this most beautiful story. And I wanted to analyze this story, however, not at the usual superficial level, obviously, but to really get to the core of what is this epic that is told and retold year after year, now for probably 3 or maybe even 5,000 years. We don't know when it started because it was passed along orally for many, many generations before it was first written down. And then it was rewritten by different sages in many different times, even up into the Middle Ages. So the Ramayana that we have now is not the original Ramayana, and I want to analyze the original one, because that's where the secrets, the messages that we are interested in, were originally encoded by enlightened sages who created this epic, which is the first literary epic poem in history. It's long before the Iliad and the Odyssey or the Mahabharata or any of the others. This is the basic fundamental literary text of world culture. And it has spread. So the Ramayana will be celebrated in Bali and will be celebrated in Indochina, will be celebrated in many different places. And in Africa, other places where their Indian expats have settled over the centuries, and it is a story that has universal appeal. But in the same way that among the Orthodox Rebbes in Judaism, when they analyze a section of the Torah, they analyze it in four different levels. They use an acronym called Pardes for Peshat, Remez, Darash, and Sod. But it basically means that to apply it to the Ramayana, some Orthodox Hindus will take this as simply history. This is what happened. And will take it simply at face value. And that would be the first level of analysis. Obviously, we're not going to do that. But the second level would be to take it as an allegory and to understand that we are given moral and ethical lessons of good versus evil and how karma works and all of that. But then there's a third level where we actually begin to deal with what are these symbols telling us at a deeper level, and looking at the etymology of the words and their interconnections and the patterns that are present within the text that are more subliminal but that are converging on certain deeper insights. And then at the fourth level, the sod, the secret level, what's the real mystical teaching of this great work of art? What is it really telling us? And then the Hasidim say there's a fifth level, which is the sod of the sod, the core of the secret, the actual a mystery that even the sages don't understand until a certain moment happens when, like a time capsule, an understanding of the meaning will suddenly break open, and those who have reached that deepest level will find yet another, even deeper level of meaning that will be so powerful that it will be transformative just to get it. Okay? Well, this week that level happened to me as I was analyzing the Ramayana. And I believe that there's an interpretation that can now be given that will be have an extraordinary impact because of its a capacity to penetrate to the heart of the real and to show us something about ourselves, about our own consciousness that we may never have seen and probably have not recognized because that level of revelation was not made available. And it may be that this same insight is happening in many places to many of people studying this text at this time because the morphogenic field tends to work that way. But nonetheless, there is a teaching here that is extremely relevant for this moment in history. And if we understand that the story is about the loss of the kingdom of God and the return to that kingdom, the conquest of those forces that were hindering the establishment of heaven on earth, Ram Rajya, as they call it in Sanskrit, we are now at that historic moment when the Ramayana is now finally fully being enacted as the theodrama of our lives at this time. And for us to understand that and the role that we are now able to play if we have that understanding will, I think, shift everyone's capacity to relate and establish their consciousness at that level, not just of Hanuman, but of Ram and of the entirety of the manifold field of meaning that the epic poem presents for us as a mirror of the inner self. So that's what the retreat is about, and I think those who attend will find that it will be very fulfilling to the heart's yearning to understand that meaning at the level of God consciousness of what is happening in the world today. And hopefully this will bring contentment and peace and unconditional acceptance at the same time that the consciousness is liberated from any trace of suffering. So that's what the retreat is about. And I hope that everyone here will be here to attend, and online, of course. I hope that it's able to reach those who are seeking for those answers. So that's all I have to say for this evening, and I'm going to open the floor in case anyone wants to ask a question or make any comments. Please feel free. And I think, are we going to the mic? So I think we'll do it that way. Questions are already answered, I guess. So that's good. How many people know the Ramayana? Not that many? You don't know the story of...
Only when you're talking.
Ah, okay. Well, we'll go over it. I tried to find a movie version of it. I watched about six or seven horrible. Some of them were anime and, you know, these terrible animated ones, but they were actually good compared to the Bollywood version that was, you know, with live humans. I wouldn't subject you to actually having to watch any of those, so I'll give you a plot summary. I have to say that when I was first entering into the study of Ashtanga Yoga with Baba Haridas, Haridas was into the Ramayana big time, and the group that had come together to study with Babaji were all asked to play parts, and the play was actually put on. So I saw a version, and the script was written by Baba Haridas, and it was actually a very moving play. So that has stayed with me as an initial impression of a teaching that I got at a moment when I was very open to learning whatever I could. Not that I'm not now, but that I was totally innocent and without any real background at that time in Indian philosophy. And so I found the play moving even at that probably, you know, primary level. But it's a story that has since become the basic plot formula for so many adventure films, suspense, you know, so many heroes are based on the characters in the Ramayana. And so you will, I think, find it very familiar in a way. But the analysis that I hope to be able to show you of its underlying structure, I think, will be even more extraordinary.
My question has to do with the title of the retreat, and I don't remember it quite exactly, but you talk about the heroism of Hanuman, and I was intrigued by that word because you seem to have highlighted the fact that there is a hero's journey. My interpretation, you don't say that, that is there, that we should pay attention to, or is a model perhaps of a story or of a myth that is very important. And so maybe my question is, why the choice of hero at this time? Maybe it's an important, I know there's a hero's journey, but I don't know if there's anything in the background in addition to the hero's journey concept that we understand.
Well, there's a huge amount, but that's what the retreat is about. Oh, right? I would end up, spilling the entire retreat if we go into that.
Right.
But indeed, this is a moment when we all have to rise to the occasion. Those of us who want to be able to serve and not just be victims or, you know, bystanders who are crushed by these events, but we want to actually be able to be victorious over what seemed to be very adverse circumstances, and reach our true immortal nature, so that the continuity of consciousness is not cut at the moment of the destruction, and we are able to serve as agents of the new creation as well, and to populate the world that will be coming into being. In the next phase of the cycle of time, but it is It is a different kind of heroism, a spiritual heroism, mm-hmm. not the kind that does martial combat on the physical mm-hmm. level, but the fearlessness of remaining totally vulnerable and open and in a state of divine love, completely free of anger, completely free of aggression, completely free of the desire for vengeance or retaliation or for any kind of egocentric sense of right or of power to dominate. All of that has to be released so that the purity of divine consciousness fills the heart and enables us to live in a state where we can be givers of peace and of healing shakti, energy that is not tainted or contaminated by anxiety. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we have to have reached that stage of self-liberation from the egoic nature into the purity, at least of the soul level of consciousness. And that requires a very heroic effort to break through the ego's system of demands and of loyalties to the attachments it has created on the phenomenal plane. And all of that has to be cut. So that does take a kind of heroism that is much more subtle than the kind that'll just, go out and fight and kill and die. But to kill one's own ego and die to the limited self so that the unlimited can be realized, that's the kind of heroism that's now required.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question. Here's the archetype in person.
Thank you so much, Shunya. I really have appreciated already exploring this archetype through these last many years, but also recently since this retreat was announced, I feel like there's already been this sort of deepening of paying attention to what it really means. And a few things that you've said recently have stood out to me. One was when you talked about how the idea or the character of Ravana is really my own ego, and that part of myself has stolen the soul, the Sita, mm-hmm. and it takes that heroic part of myself that's able to devote itself to God, to Ram, to Rama, in order to rescue that mm-hmm. part of myself from this other mm-hmm. Demonic part of myself. Mm-hmm. And so applying it to my internal construct has helped to not make it about something mm-hmm. outside of myself.
Right.
And I guess what I'm curious about right now is how to even more clearly detach from it being about me. Like, perhaps I've been given that name for a reason mm-hmm. through in my process, but at this moment it feels more like this is something about everyone's inner Hanuman. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think there was at first some anxiety about, like, oh my God, this is, how am I going to take this in? This is about me, and I need to really learn, or I need to, what am I going to do? I need to be able to act it out in some way. And I mean, that maybe that's going to happen on its own in life and the circumstances of things that have unfolded recently have provided some situations that I need to be able to stand grounded and take responsibility. And so there's so much that's giving me this sense of trust in it, but also I want to be really clear about, like, not making it about some imaginary task
That's right.
in my mind.
Well, remember, it's an archetype, so the archetype is never about the ego. So it's not about the me, and it's not about me doing something and acting it out or anything like that. No, it's the surrender of the me to this higher self, that only from that level can the soul be freed and consciousness be able to rise and return to the divine nature. So it's don't let your ego get involved at all. It's the transcendence of ego that's being really spoken about in this context. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. But we'll go much more deeply into it in the retreat. I could talk for hours about that point now, but then I'd have nothing left to say during the retreat. So, you know, we'd got to save a little bit for that. And also, there isn't time tonight to really go into the depth of answering your question the way it deserves. But in the retreat, of course, we're going to spend a lot of time on that precise point of how that is realized and how that transmutation happens and then what it brings about in life. Okay? So, thank you, Hanuman.
I have a question. Recently, I was pondering again about the saying, "The next Buddha will be a Sangha." So, in the past, I always saw it like, "Well, we are working together and growing together," and suddenly there's a kind of shift, and everyone is becoming a Buddha simultaneously. But now, as the time is running a little short, things are getting worse outside. No one is really transcending. So I wonder, what does it mean, really, the next Buddha will be a Sangha? One could also see it on a fragmented level, right? That everyone is reaching a part of liberation, and only we all together being the Buddha then, or I don't know.
No, I think you're prematurely condemning us to failure. The Sangha will rise to the occasion, but it has to happen at a certain moment. You know, when you start to heat up water for a long time, it doesn't seem like anything is happening at all. And then suddenly it boils and it turns into steam. But that's in that final moment. And we haven't yet reached the point where the steam is rising, but we are getting hotter and hotter. And so don't lose faith that we are going to become a realized field of divine presence. Because it is never an individual. It never was an individual that became a Buddha. That whole idea that someone becomes enlightened or becomes liberated, those terms are used for those who don't get it and who are identified as individuals. But it's that individual identity is false, and it will fade away. And what remains is this field of consciousness that will animate all the bodies with a single intelligence. This will happen not because the egos have realized it or grown. No, they will simply have disappeared because they won't have any capacity to function. They will literally collapse in the same way that society is collapsing and dissolve. But in that depersonalization that will happen, rather than a breakdown, it will become a breakthrough into the Buddha nature or the infinite self. But it will be a time when ego consciousness is no longer sustainable, and a different level of consciousness will become necessary even just for survival. And the way that relationships happen from all of the forces that will be present in the field will create that shift, that boiling of the energies into a unified mass of consciousness that is divinized. So it will happen by the grace of that power, not by the efforts of those who think that they have to do this but don't know how and feel hopeless and all of that. No, that will disappear from the plane of immanence and an entirely higher level of the transcendental self will merge with the immanent reality and divinize it as a single whole.
Okay, but the signifier Sangha seems to be a limited amount of people or limited space.
We have a global
or
Sangha. We're talking about a Sangha that's planet-wide.
Yes, okay.
So it's not just the people here. We will be a non-local consciousness. And there will be members of the Sangha who don't even know they're members of the Sangha. It's not the Sangha that pertains to a particular brand name, but to a vibrational frequency. Mm-hmm. And that is what's going to be unified.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say how joyful and grateful I am to be here. And I just like sort of overflowing some part of me that this is happening and that you're saying what you're saying. And anyway, I'm just so overwhelmed and joyful and grateful. That's all I have to say.
Good. And blessings to you. And it's meant that you're here. God has brought you here for this. And no doubt you will share this with many others and uplift many souls because of the fullness of your own heart and of the realization of your divine nature that will naturally be offered to everyone you meet. So thank you. Last call. Anyone else want to speak for any reason?
Thank you. Something that's been coming up in meditation is a question about the highest level of our consciousness, whether that's a particular frequency or it's no frequency at all. I'd like to understand what discernment is needed.
It's actually all frequencies, but it is the source of the whole spectrum of frequencies of consciousness, from the highest to the lowest. But it is indeed the source that is such stillness that there's no vibration happening. But even within that stillness, because it emanates the spectrum, there's a slight push of what they call the spanda or the ahamspurana, a slight whisper of a frequency that then builds up into the entire spectrum and transforms the unified field and begins to coagulate quantum wave functions and produce those archetypal forms that create a world that will be perceived. Mm-hmm. So it begins even at that level of the ultimate reality that the potency is just slightly activated to make the whole thing go.
So when you were speaking about like the realization that happened for you this week, that kind of the source of the source kind of emerging, is it kind of pre that initial vibration where those kinds of insights are?
That's where it comes from.
Yeah.
But then it'll travel to whatever level one has reached. And if one's at too low a level, it gets scrambled, and one gets a message that is maybe partially true and partially a fantasy. And right, so one has to be at a very high and clear state to get the message coherently and clearly and accurately. Mm. Otherwise, many people receive messages, but they're always slightly off because it got mixed with ego fantasies or with a certain sanskaras or memories of other lives or whatever, and the information did not get accurately transmitted to be expressed. That happens a lot. Mm-hmm. So, yes, one has a responsibility to be a very clear transceiver of whatever is one is graced with receiving from that source.
Mm. Thank you, Shunya.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shunya, for tonight. I wanted to ask actually about the documentary that we watched last night, the Kandinsky. I found it very, very moving, and especially his writing, which Ajata shared a few quotes of his writing. It seemed very, very fascinating, and also it almost seemed as art as philosophy, or a kind of...
Yeah. Spiritual philosophy.
Right.
Indeed. Yes.
And so I'm wondering, what is... So he's very clear about what it is that he's painting, and the later paintings as well, what each shape means and the relationship to the color. What's happened? So, and I'm looking at the picture, and there's a feeling state, but I wouldn't say that I go into a kind of a symbolic. It's more like a silence or a startling into. So am I? Is what he's communicating universal, or is it specific, or?
That's a good question. I think it has both. There's a code there, and if one contemplates it enough, and one begins to see how certain structures like triangles and circles and other forms are relating to each other, and the symmetries that are present. And the figures that occasionally do appear or can be seen in the melange of structures begin to offer something like a symbolic narrative to those who can read the text of it.
Right.
So it's like a hieroglyph, and I think that the more that one gazes at it with an openness to receive its message, the more that it can affect anyone, even at a universal level. But the more you have cultivated a taste for that particular genre and idiom of communication that he has built up over many, many paintings, right? Well, there's a language, a vocabulary, and an ability then to make sense of those symbols and see in it what was his intention, you know, and it becomes ever more clear the more one is able to gaze without creating any interference from one's own ideas. Mm. But it does come. And so I think these are like mandalas, or yantras, they're meditation objects, right. Not just to look at quickly and say, oh, that was pretty, you know, there's something much deeper. And I think if you do read his books, then, of course, it becomes much easier to see what he's getting at. Mm.
Okay. Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Ah, okay.
So about the financial situation, it seems that there's a controlled demolition going on and a provided solution that's going to be headed towards the CBDCs.
That's what they think, yeah.
So could you speak more on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, those who are losing power, their only hope is to create a slavery system that cannot be defeated, and they think that these digital currencies that are actually social credits, it's not even money any longer, it's the right to do something and to function in the society that can be taken away at will, at the whim of whoever's in charge of the central bank or the facility that distributes and controls those credits. You know, once however the system has lost legitimacy, I don't think they're going to be able to translate the collapse of a bankrupt system that is bankrupt because of their malfeasance and greed and corruption into letting those same beings run a system that's even more enslaving. So I think that the pushback that's happening now is going to generalize against the reset and not just the CBDCs, but also the WHO's treaty that it would control the health policies and be able to demand forced injections of anyone anywhere, right, for whatever reason. So all of that is being, I think, seen now for what it is and the threat that it constitutes. So the pushback is going to get ever more extreme in the opposition to it. So this is not going to be a quick slide into their new world order. That's not going to happen. But it requires not only a wakefulness, but a real heroism, not just of the spiritual kind, but of the symbolic kind that is willing to stand up and communicate and express very strongly the truth of what is going on and disseminate that information widely in a way that is able to overcome the censorship of the media. So there's a major struggle that's going on right now on the internet and on all of the means and media of communication, and this is coming to a head as well. Probably it will bring about an engineered collapse of the internet as well, and as well as coinciding with the food shortage becoming an extreme famine situation, so that people are in a survival mode and they're not able to function at a higher level of coherence and unity because they're scrounging to find some food to feed their kids or whatever, right? And so as the extremity it continues to escalate, there will also be much more crime and violence and total chaos in the urban areas, I think, of every nation. And I don't think anyone's going to escape the effects of this. And there will have to be Buddha-like sanghas that are oases of peace and coherence that are able to form in the midst of the chaos, where the light can still shine and create a connected force field of consciousness that can override the negative intentions of those forces that are behind the enslavement, and bring a final freeing of human consciousness from the level at which it could be enslaved to a level that is inherently beyond capture by any forces.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, this will be the last question.
Do you think there is some alternative, like the anarcho-pulco, decentralized cryptocurrencies, or Nisera, Gesera, or any of those things?
I don't think any of them are going to work, especially when the internet is down and, you know, these, the whole digital world is going to collapse. And so I think we're dealing with a situation where love will be the currency, love and light and peace. And if you can bring that to someone in a situation where they're freaking out and give them a sense of coherence and wisdom and empowerment to be able to deal with what is lacking in the environment, even food shortages, one will be able to survive through all of that, and one will be able to, when it's time to leave the body, to do so in a consciousness that remains fully awakened and able to function in an incorporeal level of the virtual dimension of our world, and actually be even more powerful without a body than those who are still identified in and with a body.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, I hope that this satsang was useful and that it instills hope and not fear, and but not denial either, and not a sense that, oh, there's years to go before, you know, we reach the chaos. It's happening here and now, and escalating at a very rapid pace. So we have to escalate our spiritual efforts at least at the same rate in order to be able to stay in a state in which we can not only function, but become leaders of that wave of transformation that is underway, and be able to lift all boats in the rising tide of consciousness of those who are seeking to also divinize their consciousness and be free from the egoic fragility and tendency to break down. So we have to eliminate all weakness from the consciousness, and that can only be done if we fully return to our true nature. So this must be our one priority on a ceaseless, constant basis, and that will bring redemption. So blessings to all for the realization of the supreme reality and the embodiment of that power of divine love and divine fearlessness to be able to serve in the way that we have been asked to do by the Lord of Yoga, who is our real teacher and guide, and the Satguru, who abides in the heart of every being who is true to their real nature. So may we all realize that self here and now, and spread the vibrational frequency of liberation to all. Namaste.
Namaste.